I speak to you in the name of God. Amen. Yesterday, I was looking for a favorite shirt in the closet, and I discovered all my old love letters to my wife. I'm embarrassed to admit to myself all the things I wrote back then. My only excuse that I was young and in love, filled with great passion and longing from that primitive era before email, when I would not know my beloved's response for several days. These letters are tickets into the soul of a young man. I sat on the floor with my back against our bed, reading the letters for a while, until I shed my embarrassment about expressions of passion. But man, did I ever want to be important in those days. Yes, I know lovers posture toward each other, and I know that young egos can be unbounded. But reading through my love letters from 55 years ago, I realized how much I wanted to be somebody, to be really important in life. Although it's a desire that hangs around for life, that hope to stand out, to be important, to do something great, memorable, and lasting is most compelling to the young. The longer we live, you know, the more reality sets in. But since Jesus' disciples were almost certainly young, it cannot be surprising that they thought the thoughts of young men and wondered about great things in their future. One day they were traveling along, and the young men argued about the pecking order. I imagined something like the back seat of our station wagon when I was a kid. We always argued, there were five children, we always argued whose turn it was to have a pillow, who had to sit in the middle, who still had crackers left from lunch, and so on and on and on and on. My parents were in the front seat, and in those days before car air conditioning, you know, the windows were open and nobody could hear anything. Every so often my mother would lift her head, tilt her head back and yell, "What are you kids arguing about?" Like the guys who traveled with Jesus, we said nothing. As much as we argued, it was as if there was a kind of a conspiracy of silence among us. The argument was ours, not our mother's. And she never pushed the issue until we stopped, then she grilled us. So once Jesus and the young men got inside, away from the crowd, he pressed the question, "What were you arguing about on the way?" And they kept silence. My mother always knew what we argued about in the back seat because it never changed. We may have been fussing about pillows and crackers and games, but we were jostling for affection, arguing about importance and positioning ourselves to be more valued than the others. The young men would not let Jesus in on their conspiracy of silence and argument. They kept silence. Nevertheless, Jesus went right on, sat down and called everybody to him so that he could treat them like the children they resembled and teach them about true greatness. And this is what he said. "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and the servant of all. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me, welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." That is shocking. Jesus took the least important of all people in that culture, a child, and said, "Behold, true greatness." The stunning and disorienting irony about Jesus' response to the aspirations of his young friends is that the rules just changed. In regular life, certainly now, and almost certainly then, greatness is a sometime thing. We may dream about it, hope for it, seek it out. We may arrange our lives to be in position to do important things. But without the right gifts, or appropriate training, or the serendipitous smile of good fortune, we may live and die as ordinary people. But in a quietly revolutionary way, born in savage humiliation that few of us could endure. Jesus placed greatness within our reach. To be great no longer requires power or achievement or fame. It only needs love and service. At first hearing, that sounds kind of depressing. All my love letters for naught. All my hard work, a wasted effort. If all I ever had to do was to be kind to a child, I should have spent more time looking for children. When I graduated from Yale Divinity School in 1972, I asked the bishop, the Methodist bishop, to appoint me to be pastor of an urban parish. I think I probably had something like St. Paul's Cathedral in Buffalo in mind. A place where I could just seamlessly transfer my energy from the Ivy League to the seat of church power. So the bishop gave me what I asked and appointed me to be pastor of the Opa-locka United Methodist Church in Opa-locka, Florida. Anybody been to Opa-locka? I know Dave has. It's a wretched, rundown corner of Dade County, far from the glitz and glamour of Miami Beach. It was a small blue-collar city, dramatically and tragically divided by race and 27th Avenue, a terrible place where the hotel in the small downtown doubled as a brothel. The local peewee football coach was arrested for shooting two of his players, where the local drugstore lunch counter was always crowded with the hulking guy and his battered wife, where our doctor was a pill-pushing quack, where my church treasurer was run down and killed by a political opponent on the city hall steps. Into this place of service, I came straight from Yale with my wife and preschool son. There was mildew all through the parsonage, which was overrun with roaches. It was furnished with cheap, royal blue Danish modern furniture with red and purple stripes over a gray-green shag carpet. The house was not air-conditioned, had never been fumigated. Into this place of service I came, determined to be important and do great things. The truth is, I didn't know what I was doing. That's the truth. I was barely dry behind my ministerial ears. I was making things up as I went along. But across the street from us lived Frances Grimm. She was a widow with a teenage son. She watched over us. She loved us. She invited us to dinner often, reassured us that we were not terrible parents. She persuaded my wife that she did not have to live up to the virtuous wife in Proverbs. She came patiently to all my ridiculously cerebral study courses and made the best spaghetti I'd ever eaten. In a rough and turbulent place, Frances Grimm was kind and life-saving to us. She is long dead now. After we moved from that place, we gradually lost contact, but I did hear that she moved back to Alabama and died from her weak heart. But once I grew up enough to hear the gospel, I knew that a young, ambitious pastor had been loved and cherished by a great pastor. As you try to measure your life by all the criteria of power and influence, achievement and importance, do not neglect the only measure of greatness among us who follow Jesus. Whoever wants to be first must be last and servant of all. According to that standard, we all may be great. Amen.